This is a Carlisle ValueCast, brought to you by the Carlisle Group. ValueCast brings you insights from our One Carlisle Network, providing analysis, data, and observations to help you navigate the global economy and top-of-mind issues in news. The Carlisle Group. Invest wisely. Create value.
Greetings and welcome to Carlisle ValueCast. I'm Chris Ullman, head of Carlisle's Global Communications. Today, our guest is Glenn Youngkin, Carlisle's President and Chief Operating Officer, here to chat with us about infrastructure investing. Welcome, Glenn.
Chris, thank you for having me.
So, Glenn, there is a lot of talk these days about infrastructure here in Washington, all around the country. What is going on, and how does this impact us?
This is both an easy and a hard question. The easy question really gets to the importance of infrastructure for our country and really the bipartisan nature of the issue. Just recently, the American Society of Civil Engineers published their 2017 report card on American infrastructure. The report card today grades American infrastructure as a D+. We find ourselves in this circumstance today where we all know American infrastructure has deteriorated beyond compare. The estimate is over the course of the next 10 years, there's a $2 trillion gap in what needs to be spent versus what is scheduled to be spent. Here in Washington, that reality is bubbling into a very active discussion around what to do. We find ourselves with a universal agreement. We need to do something. But the big question is, what do we do? The president recently sent over in his first draft of his budget a very clear statement that we need infrastructure spending and his beginnings of a program for infrastructure spending. We have both sides of the House and the Senate recognizing that we do need to have an infrastructure bill. What all this turns into is where the debate lies. The reality, of course, is that infrastructure needs really are at the state and local level. 90%+ of infrastructure assets are owned by or reside in the states or municipalities, not at the federal level. And as a result, the cooperation that's needed in order to implement an infrastructure plan extends far beyond Washington and, in fact, requires local governments, state governments, and the federal government to cooperate. What does this mean for Carlisle? It's a great opportunity, I think. The expectations are that this will be a partnership with government, federal, some state and local spending, but a lot of private sector investment. And that investment will be provided by firms like Carlisle and the many investors that back us. We view this as an opportunity to provide a great investment opportunity for our investors and for Carlisle, but also to participate in a great national need.
I've been in Washington for 30 years, and the talk about spending money on infrastructure comes up every year. Is this time going to be different?
I sure hope so. The difference today is the fact that we almost have no choice, where the infrastructure in the United States has fallen so far behind relative to our peers. Anybody who travels internationally today recognizes it immediately. The quality of the airports, the quality of the roads and bridges, the quality of internet service, and that puts the United States at a material disadvantage. I'm hoping that this reality is one that galvanizes bipartisan support and we can actually not just get movement legislatively or leadership from the White House, but support across the investment community and in the state and local level so that when we do get an opportunity to move forward with an infrastructure project, all the pieces are in place and we can lock hands and go.
You talked about four different entities, state, local, federal, and private, such as us. How are we all trying to work together, or are we?
The key to all of this is learning from the historic challenges of galvanizing movement in infrastructure. Historically, there's been both the capacity and the philosophical position that infrastructure spending should start in Washington. And therefore, a spending program and selecting projects and driving infrastructure spend almost as a works program, which really started with the Great Depression, is the way infrastructure spending should work. And the reality is that given our fiscal challenges in the United States, it can't be run that way. And I think everyone recognizes that. And therefore, the role of the private sector in what is called P3s, or public-private partnerships, has gained a prominent position in the overall series of tools that are going to be brought to bear on closing this infrastructure gap. this P3 does require all of these entities to cooperate in order to get an outcome.
So let's talk a few technical terms here. So you said P3, public-private partnership. I've also heard that term privatization. Are they the same or are they different?
They're different. Privatization is the sale of a entity that's owned by a government into private hands. The example that most people think of is Margaret Thatcher when she privatized British Airways. British Airways went from being owned by the government to being owned by private shareholders. That's quite different than the concept of a public-private partnership. A public-private partnership has three key components. The first is that a concession is actually granted with regards to a critical infrastructure asset for a private sector entity to have the rights to run it and to garner revenue streams and be responsible for expenses, both operating and maintenance and capital improvements. So you're shifting the economic responsibility for an entity from public hands to private hands. And that's done through a concession agreement. The important thing about a concession agreement is it has a finite time period. They tend to run 30 to 99 years. It's a long-term lease. The second key component is all of the safety valves that are put in place to make sure that the critical infrastructure project is managed, operated in a way that delivers the outcomes that the municipality needs. Safety, investment, uptime, critical performance indicators, which in private business we're used to running with all the time. These concessions are written in a way that if the party that's operating the critical asset doesn't meet those critical performance indicators, they first will suffer penalties and then they lose the concession. And the government entity takes it back.
So the government is holding the private entity accountable there.
Absolutely. And then the third element of all of this is arranging the capital to pay an upfront fee to the municipality or the state or the federal entity that owns this critical infrastructure asset and the capital to invest in it over a long period of time. This is a very standard arrangement that is being used all around the world, more so in Australia, in Canada, and in Europe. And it's been used a few times in the U.S. successfully. As we get more attuned to the best practices about how to implement P3s, we will find that this arrangement allows us to not only upgrade our infrastructure, but to actually liberate capital from those infrastructure assets and invest in new infrastructure. This is one of the most interesting parts of these P3 arrangements. In many critical infrastructure assets, and let's take airports for example, an airport that is owned by a municipality already has a revenue stream. So it's a commercial entity and they have expenses. As a result, that infrastructure asset, that airport, has value. But that value is kind of stuck in that airport, unlike a business where that value may be recognized by the owners of that asset. And municipalities don't always recognize the value of that asset. And so the secondary benefit of a P3 arrangement is oftentimes there's an upfront payment. And if the legislation is correct, the municipality can use that cash to invest in a new infrastructure project. This was the really bright idea that came from our friends in Australia. And they called it asset recycling, a way to not only invest in that asset, but liberate value in that asset through the payment to the municipality of the right to run that asset for 30 to 99 years, and recycling that value, that cash, into a new infrastructure project.
So who's doing the recycling?
Usually the municipal government. And they choose, oh, I need a new toll road, new bridges, a new telecom infrastructure, or investment in my port, or in my wastewater system. And they can use that cash to do that. Otherwise, they wouldn't have had that money. This is a virtuous cycle of taking asset value, realizing some of it, and using those proceeds to invest in new infrastructure. This is why we're very careful not to use the word privatization, because what I just described over the last few minutes is anything but privatization. What I described is actually partnering to upgrade, invest, operate, and increase customer service levels in existing assets, and liberating value to provide cash, real money, to go invest in new infrastructure projects.
In your discussions with government officials and bankers and the like, what kind of buy-in is there, and what is it going to take to actually do this?
So there's good news and bad news here. The good news is all parties agree with the attractiveness of this basic concept. It really doesn't require monumental changes in current operating structures or legislative packages in order to do this. So we don't need some omnibus bill that's 6 feet high that's been debated for 2 years to make it through Congress in order to enable this. Today, there are public-private partnerships up and running around the United States. LaGuardia Airport, that terminal is being constructed under a public-private partnership arrangement. If you've driven from LaGuardia Airport north to Connecticut and been on Interstate 95 or 395 or the Merritt Parkway and stopped at one of the rest stops along the way, that rest stop was actually revitalized through a public-private partnership, which happened to be done with Carlisle. And so public-private partnerships are up and running without any major federal movement. There's airports moving forward with their own public-private partnership plans, like the St. Louis Airport was recently approved to engage in a public-private partnership for its own expansion. So this happens because of the merit of the concept. Now, the bad news, there are elements that are needed through legislation in order to take this concept from first gear and move it into fifth gear. The way the legal framework works, if you are a toll road or a state highway, and you're gonna become a toll road, or you're an airport and you wanna engage in a public-private partnership, and you've taken any money from the federal government, you have to return money to the federal government should you liberate any of these proceeds. One element that legislation needs to address is if people are going to engage in public-private partnerships, being able to maintain proceeds gleaned through the partnership and being able to keep those at the state or local level is really important. One big element that the federal government, and in fact the recent Trump plan, is trying to include is an incentive for state and local governments to initiate public-private partnerships. The basic concept is, can the state government or the local government receive additional support, additional funds for those new infrastructure projects if capital is liberated through a public-private partnership in an existing critical infrastructure? That's what Australia did. They did it extraordinarily well, and the federal government in Australia actually just paid a bonus to their equivalent of their states and local governments that initiated successful P3s and used those proceeds to invest in new infrastructure. And so there would be an additional bonus that would go with the recycling proceeds to leverage those proceeds, make them more powerful, and invest in more infrastructure. That's part of the administration's plan. Order of magnitude here is important. The administration is trying to invest over $1 trillion. Their goal is to have $200 billion that would be in the support for this whole process to attract as much as $800 to $1 trillion over the next 10 years of private capital to be the primary financial engine behind these P3s.
Glenn, you mentioned several highway service plazas in Connecticut and that Carlisle was involved with that. Tell us a little bit about that effort.
It was a really innovative approach to solve a problem that I don't think that the state of Connecticut actually fully understood. Some smart cookie inside the state government at the time recognized that the leases on these aging service plazas were coming due with the old food providers and gas providers. And they were wondering what to do with them. Most of the service plazas were old and crumbling and had bad lighting and bad bathrooms and nobody stopped. And so the concept must have been like a light switch just going off in someone's head of, well, why don't we bring in capital? Why don't we bring in a philosophy like running a mall on these service plazas, and we can get someone to pay to provide the capital expenditures, invite in new food offerings and shopping and a much better experience for anyone who does stop, and fundamentally upgrade the service levels. But oh, by the way, as the state of Connecticut, make some money along the way and alleviate the expense associated with upgrading all of these. And so they did, and they initiated a P3 process. Carlisle bid and won, and winning enabled us to have the right to invest over $150 million in the service plazas. Over the course of 4 years, reconstruct a service offering to people on those highways that is second to none. Traffic through the service plazas has gone up over 60%. And oh, by the way, the state of Connecticut has a revenue share with us. And so when someone, in fact, spends money on those service plazas, a small part of it actually goes to the state of Connecticut. So they alleviated expense, they upgraded the plazas themselves, and have a much better customer service level, and they receive part of the proceeds from the revenue. So that's a public-private partnership.
What else is Carlisle doing in that space?
Today, the big prospects for public-private partnerships are the airports around the country. There's an extraordinary amount of investment need in airports as air traffic expands and as we make the travel experience better. Most airports in this country were built 30, 40, 50 years ago, and they weren't built for modern air traffic. Much of it needs to almost be rebuilt. That's probably going to be the top prospect for investing in infrastructure over the near term. Over the long term, we fully expect that all of the other areas of port operations and water and potentially highways and bridges all fall into this concept.
Let's walk through a hypothetical asset renewal with an airport. How does that work?
So you have an airport, it's worth $500 million. And that airport has a new construction project. And let's say that new construction project is going to require $2 billion. What they would do is sign a concession with somebody to operate that airport in a public-private partnership for 50 to 100 years. That entity would pay the airport some capital. And let's just say they pay over $250 or $300 million to the airport. They also take on the responsibility to invest the $2 billion in the construction project, and they take on all the responsibilities to maintain that airport and continue to invest in that airport to keep it state of the art. What that concession gets in return is the right to drive efficiencies and growth in that airport, drive revenue, generate more profits. They get to keep some of those profits, and they share some of those profits with the city. The city, in turn, gets to take the proceeds up front and invested in a new infrastructure project. So let's assume they have a wastewater project that they need to invest in. Then they can take those proceeds and do that. Now, this last step is what requires some government legislation in order to enable, which is to be able to keep the money and use that money for other purposes, because right now it's not allowed.
You and your team are doing a lot of educating, meeting and greeting with government officials and the like. What is your central message to them?
The infrastructure business at Carlisle is led by two gentlemen, Andrew Marino, who's a longtime veteran of Carlisle, who grew up in the private equity side of the firm, but did lots of investing in the industrial segment, and his partner, Pete Taylor, who for 20 years was investing all around the world for an Australian firm called Hastings, and he led some of the most innovative public-private partnerships, particularly in Australia, in this model of recycling. We have huge experience on how to get things done at Carlisle, coupled with huge experience in investing in public-private partnerships around the world. What's been most helpful is as we speak with folks up and down Pennsylvania Avenue and at the state and local level, it's the combination of Andrew's investment acumen in the United States particularly, but at Carlisle specifically, and Pete's broad-ranging experience about how public-private partnerships work that has made the two of them kind of the primary invite to congressional briefings, meeting with staffers all across the administration, but also up on the Hill, because they can speak to both aspects of this. What has been most encouraging is the level of open-mindedness to this concept and the desire from all of the folks working on infrastructure to make sure they have taken full advantage of the resources that are available at a place like Carlisle. So we think if we can help educate the folks who are going to be writing legislation and passing regulations around all of this, that it will be good for the whole industry, which will be good for the country.
What is the top one or two things that our government needs to do, hopefully in partnership with the private sector, to take that D-plus up to a B?
The single most important thing the government needs to do at all levels is facilitate the streamlining of the regulatory frameworks around projects like this. Because today it takes nearly 10 years to get a project approved. And as a result, these projects die under their own weight because it just takes so long. And so by actually finding a way to streamline this regulatory approval, we don't mean skirt environmental approval issues to make sure that we're doing everything appropriately, but we've just got to find a way to get on with things. If you actually impose on the private sector upfront costs just to have the right to do a project that are extraordinary and uneconomic, nothing happens. And as a result, if we can get the federal government, the state governments, and local governments lined up on the regulatory front to provide a reliable path from concept to shovel, then all of a sudden we will facilitate infrastructure spending around this country in an extraordinary way. That's number one. There's a whole bunch of number twos. There's legislative things, as I mentioned, on the ability for the states to keep the money. There's things around how municipal financing works. But the reality, Chris, is finding a way to streamline the regulatory and approval process in order to get these projects from drawing board to shovel is the number one priority.
Are there any critics out there who think that involving the private sector just is not prudent?
Of course. And some of the criticisms aren't unfounded. Because in all business, there are successes and there are often failures. That creates markets. There are examples of projects that haven't worked out the way people had wanted. Now, there's also examples of projects that were done by the government that didn't work out at all. Part of this is learning from the successes, but also learning from some of the shortcomings and making sure that when we go back to this framework we talked about right at the beginning, which is first the lease or the concession has to have built into it the appropriate requirements for what they want done from an investment, from a maintenance expenditure and operating standpoint, and all of the consumer and government protections in order to make sure that no corners are cut, that in fact the money is spent, that the service levels are held high, that the customers are treated the right way. And so you end up with a very clear requirement that if that is written well and is written based on learnings from these happening around the world and happening in the United States, then many of the critics can be assuaged. They can find out that this can work extraordinarily well. It just needs to be executed well.
Well, I think this is one of those issues where people who hit lots of potholes while driving or who wait in long lines at old rickety airports are rooting for you.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Glenn, this has been fascinating. It's a critical, an interesting subject, and we're grateful for you sharing your thoughts on this with our listeners. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on Carlisle ValueCast.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you for joining us. For more information, go to our website at www.carlisle.com. This has been a Carlisle ValueCast podcast.